And we can turn it around. And one of the women at the forefront of the effort to turn around our ecological crises and consciousness is Frances Moore LePay. As I say, she is one of my sheroes. I've interviewed her, had the pleasure to do that a couple of times over the years that I was doing Trash Talk, Eco Talk, now the Green Front. And I'm thrilled to welcome her back to my program, Frances Moore LePay. What do you say?
Thank you so much. I remember you fondly, as
That's terrific. We met, I think, in San Francisco, Marin County. I think I gave you a ride to the bus or something.
Oh,
you were taking public transportation,
yeah.
Even on a media tour.
There you
very
go.
Impressed. You have been walking the talk for decades now, of course, going back to Diet for a Small Planet. You've written or co-authored some 18 books. When do you sleep? I know you also have a pretty big family and a lot of friends.
Not enough. Life is good. I keep learning. That's what keeps me going, I think.
Thank you for teaching us. And thank you for this most provocative, most recent title, Getting a Grip 2. First of all, did I miss Getting a Grip 1?
Yeah, I guess you did.
I did.
No.
Okay.
Well, I put the 2 on there because I really did a complete rewrite of this book. It came out in 2007. And then what happened, of course, is that instead of Bush, we have Obama, and we have a world post, at least hopefully, the worst of the financial crisis. But I really felt like it was a different world I was writing in, and I wanted to capture it. So I did another version, and we put a 2 at the end of the title.
And the subtitle is Clarity, Creativity, and Courage for the World We Really Want. You ask a good question, and that is, why are we creating a world that nobody wants, or very few? Maybe some of the climate deniers and the professional anti-environmentalists, which still blows my mind that there are so many and that they are so loud and have such a platform. But what do most of us who are in touch with science and ecological reality and social, reality, really want that we're not getting?
Well, a world that we feel at ease in, a world that doesn't repel us with its injustices. And I think, I really think that even people who, have their head in the sand about climate change, et cetera, that they too, no one gets up in the morning and says, yes, I think it's great that 16,000 children are going to die today of hunger. Clearly, people know that there is something fundamentally off, and even in our own country where the gap between rich and poor is so extreme that we really aren't a middle-class society anymore, I don't think people think that that's a good idea. So I guess I'm assuming that the vast majority of us want to live in a world that is essentially fair, in which we feel we have a voice, in which we feel that we are leaving our world better for our children and grandchildren than what we ourselves inherited. And I think that's virtually universal, those, because I think actually there's a lot of evidence that sense of fairness and a sense of inclusion is really part of our genetic heritage for growing as we did over eons of time in tightly knit tribes. And so what I really come to in Getting a Grip is that we are creating a world in which we ourselves are misfits. So how could that possibly be, That's the big question.
And what do you mean by that? We activists are misfits because we still don't quite fit into
Well, I think all of us are misfits in the sense that, okay, here's my thesis, if I can do it in a nutshell, that we evolved in tightly knit tribes, actually egalitarian tribes in which, there was a, as I was just saying, a deep sense of fairness, empathy was, really, as I say, soft-wired in us because that's how we survived in our tribal roots, through cooperation based in empathy. And so a world in which there is such a huge gap and so many people are suffering absolute deprivation in the midst of plenty, it's a violation. It's a violation of our common sense and even our soft-wired proclivities, our natural way of being in the world. And that's what I mean, that we are misfits, we all of us then. And that's why depression is a global epidemic. Three or four times more than HIV. It is the fourth leading cause now of loss of reproductive life in the world. And suicide outdistances homicide by 50% in terms of the cause of death.
Not to mention what's happening with our teenagers who are increasingly, turning to drugs, alcohol, and just maladaptive,
the binge.
Behavior.
I mean, it's just staggering, the amount of alcohol that kids are consuming, and we know now what it does to brains. And so that's what I mean by we've created a world in which our natural sort of sensibilities and our common sense are denied on a daily basis. And that's what I struggle to try to... Yeah, and so we have to struggle not to be. And that's what I. That's why I write books.
Well, you know, it's a joke, but there's some truth to it. You know, half the planet is on antidepressants, and the other half, you know, should be, because, you know, if we're in touch with reality, even if you don't suffer from biochemical depression, and a lot of us do, there's reason to be discouraged. And yet you are the essence of hope. In fact, one of your bestsellers was called Hope's Edge.
Hope's Edge, which my daughter and I, Anna and I, define ourselves as possibilists, to distinguish ourselves from optimists. Is that theme of getting a grip is that it is possible that we, the humanity, can make this turn toward life. We're on a downward death march right now. But it is possible if we can get a grip, and this is the title, right, getting a grip on the root causes. And so that's why, you know, from my own life, you know, no matter how big the task is, if I can feel that my action is actually contributing to something that is shifting, that is really... you know, beginning to reshape the root causes, then I can keep going. And if I feel clueless, if I feel I have no idea about how we got here, then I really am at the edge of despair. So my work is for myself, you know, that I love sharing with others, but how do I understand how we got here? And what I end up saying is the real problem, and the only one we have to worry about, is that we've made ourselves feel powerless. And power is to have power, to have voice, is a deep human need. And once we identify the issue in terms of our self-imposed powerlessness as the key problem, then the challenge is how do we find our power? And that's really what all my work is about, because it's based on this idea that not one of us as individuals would choose this world. So how do we find our power together to create the world that we really want? And they're very, and I conclude that the only thing powerful enough to take away our power is the power of ideas to do us in. You know, I argue in the book that believing is seeing instead of seeing is believing. Believing is seeing, and that's the ideas that we hold that convince us of what is real and what is possible. So it's really very much at the level of what is the giant story that we're telling ourselves that ties our own hands.
You just mentioned finding our power together. Together is the key, is part of the equation, I know, because so many of us feel isolated and have lost that sense of community as families, you know, are not living in the same places, and as there's more divorce and broken households, and, you know, fewer of us are maybe affiliated with religious organizations. And yet, so therein lies the key, as well as, you know, the reason, part of the reason for this disintegration.
Yeah. In fact, one of the studies I love to throw into this book was University of Virginia finding they took young people, put them at the foot of a hill. One group had, both groups had heavy backpacks. One group had had a friend by their side, the other group standing alone. And then they asked them to judge the steepness of the incline of the hill, right? Mm-hmm. And those that had a friend by them judged the steepness to be significantly less than those who, you know, were standing alone. And so I think that's just, again, it goes back to our tribal roots, that we are social creatures, and this is both our blessing and our curse, you know, but the blessing piece is that we gain courage through relationship. And so I talk at the end of the book about fear very much, very directly, about my own and kind of my theory of fear, and how do we become more courageous? Because I argue in the book that human beings are good enough. We have these soft-wired, as I say, traits, you know, proclivities for fairness and empathy and effectiveness and all this good stuff. But what we need more of now is backbone. Is courage to really think thoughts that don't fit the mainstream, and that means finding people more courageous than we, associating with them, and that is one way we become more brave ourselves. And this goes into some really cool neuroscience too, but the idea really of the book is becoming not thinking we need a transformation of the human heart, but maybe we do need to strengthen the backbone.
Mm, interesting. And wouldn't you have thought, you're a mother, you're a grandmother, I'm a mother, I'm a step-grandmother. I would have thought by this age and stage in life that we would have, you know, just more progressive practices, policies, politicians, presidents all around. And we have a potentially progressive president in the White House, certainly much better than what we had. And yet we still seem to be in this surreal existence that, like you say, nobody really wants.
Yeah, and I think it, in part, I mean, part of the thesis of all of my writing and this theme of living democracy, which I've been developing for a couple of decades, is that we move, one of the reasons that we're still where we are is that even we progressives have stayed in a framework of blame and individual blame and using terms like greed, for example, rather than really facing up to the real deep challenge of creating a democratic structure process that really works. And instead, what we've ended up with is what I call privately held government. And if you know that in a sense, somebody said to me recently, a dear ally, Caesar McDowell, who's a democracy advocate in a very beautiful sense, he said, "Frankie, the problem is democracy is nobody's business." And I think what he was getting at is that, you know, we each are in our issue silos, but it's the question of what is democracy itself. And if we allow, last year it was $3.5 billion in lobbying money, mostly corporate, to influence, I believe there are now about 24 lobbyists for every person that you and I have elected to represent us in Washington. Mm-hmm. If we allow that violation of democracy, then these are the outcomes that we will get. And as long as democracy is nobody's business, we're in big trouble, you know?
Yeah, it's like I try to encourage people to take more ownership of their environment. I wanted to call my program years ago Personal Planet, Please Take Your Planet More Seriously, but the P's popped over the microphone, so it didn't use that one. But, you know, we're so into ownership and having our personal, you know, electronic devices and personal organizers and personal trainers. You know, where are we, you know, not taking our environment, you know, not quite as personally,
yes,
you know, or deeply as we might?
Yes, in fact,
ownership in a good way.
Yeah. In fact, one of the, you know, I'm very focused on what are the terms that frame our way of seeing the world, and one of the things that I've been very much focused on is what has been called publicly financed elections, public financing. There are now two bills in Congress that would enable us to have publicly funded elections for Congress. And somebody now has started using the term voter-owned elections. And I kind of like that. I think I might shift to because really that is what we're talking about, is recognizing that this is our process. It is not the corporation and the wealthy individual, that we've got to stand for democracy as being something that voters are in charge of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really am with you on that sense of why is it that we feel that democracy has, you know, something done to us or for us, and that is way beyond us. And so I am really with you on that.
I'm looking at your title, Francis, and Frankie is, if I can call you that,
yes,
since I know
please.
That's what your best friends call you, and those who have had the pleasure to work with you side by side over these decades. You've got a picture of the Statue of Liberty on the front
yes.
cover. Why that symbol?
Well, I see all of my work as really, going. I wrote a book in the 80s called Rediscovering America's Values, not the jazziest term, but it's really about taking the core truths of, you know, what is freedom, what is democracy, what is fairness, and allowing that progressives can really breathe new life into that, those terms. And I have a blog on on Alternet about, why can't we progressives seize the term freedom? You know, that this is the essence of what we're talking about. Freedom, as Harry Boyd, the philosopher, a friend of mine, says, freedom as the liberation of talents. In other words, the liberation of individuals to realize themselves. And we can only do that in community, of course. So I really feel strongly that reclaiming the Statue of Liberty as a progressive image is something that we all can be part of, that these beautiful terms, that to let freedom be taken just to mean, you know, defensive, the negative definition of freedom, just defending ourselves against each other and against the state, is really inadequate. And we must claim freedom as our freedom to really become all we can be, including creating the communities that work for us all. So that's the spirit of that image on the cover of my book.
And in the spirit of creating more hope for all of us to share and spread, let's talk about just a couple of the positive developments on the food front since I've spoken to you, and since that was your original, you know, area of interest. And I can't wait to have your daughter Anna on to talk about the climate diet. Is that
great, and
you know, the popularity of farmers markets and the slow food movement, people who might not call themselves environmentalists giving up meat, I mean, those are things that encourage me.
I think my youthful intuition that food was the great connector and the great awakener, that's so worked for me. I feel like now, it's working for so many other people and so many different aspects of life. I was just in Chicago, where I had the privilege of giving a talk at the celebration of the, I believe it's the 20th anniversary of Growing Home, which is an inner city farm, gardens, that take people in who have come out of prison. As you know, we do virtually nothing to help people get started again, and are teaching them about farming and about the food, food industry. And then they have a restaurant where people can learn how to cook and present food in a beautiful restaurant. And it was just so exciting to talk to these people who have been incarcerated and are starting whole new lives right there in the, you know, with the earth.
Well, there's an example of that going on right here in Marin County. You know, San Quentin, Death Row, a wonderful woman named Beth Lutkus is working with, you know, lifers. They've cultivated a farm. They're growing their own food. Some of that is being cut back because of state budget, you know, constraints. But, you know, she has incredible stories of, prison inmates getting excited about growing food and sustainability, and they actually do some teaching there. And, you know, maybe that's just symbolic or token, but it's sure nice to hear that we can reach people through getting in touch with their humanity.
Yes. And on the biggest scale in terms of climate change, one of the things that I'm working on now is a new little book called Liberation Ecology, in which I really try to reinforce in all of us that while, yes, climate change and addressing it, a lot of the challenges about limiting our greenhouse gas emissions, really, at a deeper level, the challenges about riding the carbon cycle, in other words, keeping that balance going, and that is where food and agriculture, and Anna can talk about this, that's why it's central that that through over the last 300 years, we've put more carbon into the atmosphere through our disruption of the land and burning of forest than we have from burning fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can turn that around, and one of the most exciting, encouraging things that I've been studying recently, that's very little known because nobody was looking for it, right, is in Africa, in West Africa, where there's a huge millions of acres being re-greened by allowing vegetation to grow, the tree cover, to intermix the tree cover with the food crops, and so the trees can help keep the nutrients in the soil and build it up and increase the food growing potential, as well as resist the encroaching desert. And 12.5 million acres have become now available to grow food. And so there's in just one country, Niger in West Africa, which most people think of as the ultimate basket case now, because there's also a lot of hunger there in other parts of the country. So I'm just picking up on the food piece of this is that it's this wonderful human connector and liberator to, as we know about how we can grow food ourselves, and it's a tremendous contributor to the climate change challenge. from all, you know, and includes the smallest farmers in Africa, you know.
Well, we just have 2 minutes left, and I just want to ask you for any concluding thoughts. And besides getting and reading your book, Getting a Grip 2, which, by the way, Peter B. Collins, a fellow radio host, calls better than two antidepressants, just in case any of us are feeling a bit discouraged as the oil gushes, the glaciers melt, and the climate legislation stalls in the Senate. Besides reading your book, which I'm going to do, what else can we do?
Well, I'm going back to the buddy system here. You know, we're talking earlier about if you, listening to us talk, you know, if you are feeling at the edge of, you know, the end of your rope at despair, I think finding others who are sharing your passion, and I hope that my book can help you get a grip, help to shift the metaphors here. You know, I think that being a drop in the bucket is gorgeous, is beautiful, if we can see the bucket, right? So I hope that my work can help us see what we can be contributing to together, and so our drops in the bucket will feel powerful. And that's really the goal of all of my work. And there's a lot of, and also about Anna's book, a lot at smallplanet.org, and I hope that this sense of possibility that we are communicating there is really useful to people.
Beautifully put, and I like to think that this radio program that has been my baby for 13 years, with not without struggle to keep it on the air, is hearing the bucket, hearing the water dropping into the bucket, so
I love
we can
it.
Hear each other share these stories and know that we're not alone. Thank you so much, Frankie.
My great pleasure.
Thank
you.
For all your great work, and I look forward to having Anna on soon, another source of inspiration. And have a great green week to all of my listeners. Thank you for joining us. We'll have Larry Schweiger on, I believe, next week. We keep bumping that interview I did with him in Nashville at Al Gore's training last week, not because it isn't fabulous, it is, but because lucky enough to have a couple of authors on this week. Francis Moore Lopez, as you just heard, and Eric Pooley in the first half of the hour. Check that out on the archives at thegreenfront.com in case you missed it. And tell your friends to listen to The Green Front. This is for all of us, or at least those who eat, breathe, or drink. Last time I checked, that was most of us. Have a good one.